Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, it's blocked by James. LeBron James with the rejection.
Welcome to the Chase Down on Almighty Baller Radio, part of Dash Radio. I'm Justin Rowan with a special guest today. There is no Carter Rodriguez, so this show's already starting off on the right foot. But we have Harsh Devave from Raptors Twitter, Raptors HQ. How are you doing today, Harsh?
Better than I was yesterday. Time heals a lot of wounds, I think.
I feel like you're the LeBron James of Raptors Twitter. Are you comfortable with that title?
Absolutely not, man. With Blake and Will around, I'm more like the Kyle Lowry of LeBron of Raptors Twitter.
Well, you're showing up, so that certainly helps.
Oh, wow.
Man, that's... The Lowry thing's so depressing. It honestly is, especially because it's not like Lowry's a guy that you ever really want to root against. He hasn't really done a lot of things in his career that make him a villain in the basketball landscape. And with being 31 years old, contract pending, this is just basically the worst time for him to, one, have that surgery on his wrist prior to playoffs and then struggle a little bit. I thought he played pretty well against the Bucks, but he wasn't Kyle Lowry. And then to have this ankle injury against the Cavs, what are your thoughts on Lowry right now?
Yeah, it's. I thought this during the Milwaukee series as well, that it's just a really rough time to talk about Kyle Lowry, because I think no matter how much we try, recency bias affects how we view him at this point in time. Like, you know,
yeah, that's kind of inevitable.
It is, and I mean, this is a team that was always going to be judged by what they did in the playoffs. And that goes, if we break that down to an individual level, that goes to DeMar and Kyle as well, about how they perform in playoff time. So for him to have the type of showing he's had, it's a little rough because, you know, like DeMar was in the middle of a playoff, with a career year with the Raptors, so was Kyle Lowry. Kyle Lowry was having an amazing season, arguably the top point guard in the East for a long time there. And ever since he's come back from his wrist injury, it just hasn't been the same. And I think up until last year, there's always been an excuse that you could find to justify his performances. Like, you could say he's worn down. He had to carry too much of a load while DeMar was out. He was injured. He was, you know, it was a bad matchup. Like, all sorts of things can be used. But I felt like this time the excuses sort of ran out. And I feel bad for him, man. I feel like he deserves better. Like, if this is the way his Raptors tenure ends, like, he deserves to be remembered as possibly the highest peak in Raptors history in terms of quality of play. Like, that's who Kyle Lowry was. So, and it sucks that we're not able to see that yet, but I'm hoping that in time, regardless of what happens with this free agency decision, that, you know, we look back on him fondly and look back on his tenure fondly.
It's tough, and like, Lowry really was the best player for this team all year. Like, as good as DeRozan's been, Lowry was still the best player, in my opinion, by a fairly convincing margin. I do give DeRozan a lot of credit, especially for that stretch where Lowry was out. I felt like he stepped up his game. But ultimately, the success of this team really does come down to Kyle Lowry. And it's funny, in games one and two of this series, the LeBron plus bench lineup wasn't effective, basically, for the first time we've seen in a long time. And I think that was partly to do with going up against Lowry plus the bench, which has always been Toronto's most productive lineup. And then you see in Game 3, without Lowry there to generate offense with that unit, it really fell apart, and the bench was what ended up deciding that game. Well, that and LeBron, but LeBron's kind of a constant.
Yeah. It's weird, man, because, again, the margin for error without Lowry for the Raptors is so small. Like, to even be in that game, to have that be a two-point game going into the fourth quarter, DeRozan basically just had to be nuclear from mid-range. And that's just how, like, that's what you need to float. And I think he did that plenty of times during that 20-game stretch when Lowry was out. Like, he had those games against New York and Washington where it's like, all right, these are all horrible shots, but they're going in, so
yeah, and we need those.
Exactly, and you need those. And I think one of the things that's really become apparent is that the Raptors' secondary and tertiary options, not secondary so much, but tertiary options are just not reliable. Like you just can't, like teams are loading up to stop DeRozan and Lowry. And if Patterson, Damari Carroll, and guys like that aren't able to, you know, make their mark on games, like it's really hard for the Raptors to win. And then it turns to Lowry and DeRozan forcing the issue, at least the turnovers, at least a bad transition defense. It's like it's just a whole host of problems that are introduced because of the supporting cast, and it's just the nature of things, man. Like we're gonna, at the end of the day, you look at the best players, and it becomes a referendum on the best players rather than the roster as a whole. But
which is exhausting, because
it is. It is.
As much as one player can control a series and really take things over, it is those secondary options and it is the role players that really do elevate you to the next level. Like when you look at the Cavs, LeBron's going to get you into any series. We saw that in 2015. Like there was nothing left. There was maybe four warm bodies for the Cavs outside of LeBron, and he was able to drag it to six games. But ultimately, you need Kyrie, you need Love, you need all these other guys to step up. And I think if I told you before the series that Kyrie Irving was going to shoot 37% from the floor, Kevin Love was going to be quiet with 15, 16 points per game, you'd feel pretty good about the Raptors' chances through three games. But it really has been those secondary options on both sides for the Raptors not stepping up, not making the right plays, and for the Cavs, those role guys have stepped up and really hit a lot of shots. And it's funny because when you look at Serge Ibaka, for example, the stat lines haven't been bad. Like, I think he's hit shots at a better rate this series than he did against Milwaukee. He's doing a lot of things well. But when DeRozan gets trapped automatically and passes to Ibaka at 18 feet, even though he's open, that's not necessarily the best look. Like, yeah. I feel too many of these guys are rushing shots and they're not able to get into their offense. And even if you hit shots, that's not building momentum or something that you can draw upon for later in the game.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the Raptors, writers and columnists have pointed that out, that those quick trigger pick and pop, Serge Ibaka long twos and threes, like those are going to be available at any point in the shot clock. Mm-hmm. Because essentially teams are going to be making the decision whether they want to double Lowry, how they want to defend that pick and roll, Lowry or DeRozan, I should say. And essentially that shot, whether it's like with 3 seconds left in the shot clock or 21, that shot will always be available. And it's just like, we don't need to settle for that. We can work better offense and find a better shot elsewhere, because as capable as Serge Ibaka is of making that shot, he also tends to be very streaky, and yep, you don't really know what you're going to get from game to game or quarter to quarter at times. So I would rather just, you know, work our offense a little bit better, do some different things, maybe work the driving kick game a little bit more, like, or work a pick and roll. Like, I'm not sure what the exact solution is at this point, but I agree with you. Like, those shots are, they seem like good shots when they go in, but I just don't think the method is correct in terms of the end result.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we saw some adjustments from Casey that I liked in Game 3 as well. There were fewer screens for DeRozan. They were letting him work kind of one-on-one more, which really helped because it limits the Cavs' ability to trap. It limits their ability to bring that second guy. And DeRozan was actually able to get some momentum going. He was able to get to the line. Getting J.R. Smith in foul trouble was obviously huge, as he has done a good job on him. But before we move on completely from Kyle Lowry, what is your opinion of this contract status? Like, do you think they're going to need to give him the full 5 years in order to prevent him from leaving? What do you think the market's really going to be like for him? Because, as you said, for most of the season, he really has been the best point guard, at least in the conference. And on the other hand, you have these issues. You have durability. That's a question. He's 31. He's a shorter point guard. There's so many things that go into the decision that it's really hard to get a read on what's going to happen.
Yeah, there's even been some cases where guys get wrist surgery and they don't really come back the same at any point. I think Deron Williams was one of those guys. I'm not entirely sure, but
Deron Williams, the best point guard in the East now.
Yeah, I mean, he's an upgrade on Kyrie, so I'm kidding. I know you guys love Kyrie. I'm just joking. But yeah, no, with Lowry, like, I think it's really sad how this is going. Like, this really resembles the Chris Bosh situation where he gets hurt and we're teased about whether he's going to play the next game, almost every game, and then he ends up not playing and bam, season's over and he leaves in free agency. And, you know, that there's some similarities there. It's kind of scary, to be honest, but
that's depressing. Raptors, that's really depressing.
It is, man. Like, dude, Lowry might have played his last game as a Raptor. Like, that's the reality right now. You know, that's really sad. But in terms of what the Raptors do, I think Masai is going to try to re-sign him. I think the Raptors know that they go as Kyle Lowry goes, and it's going to be those last 2-3 years of that contract are going to be painful. But I just don't think there's any realistic route to contention for this team right now, or even like quasi contention without Lowry on the squad. Like DeRozan, right. You need DeRozan to go absolutely apeshit like he did last game in order to stay in games. Like that's not going to cut it. That's not a realistic route to success.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Raptors are going to try to re-sign Lowry. I'm not as convinced that I don't think it's a case like DeRozan last year where he's on the first day of free agency, he's going to pick up the call from Masai and sign within the first 2 hours. I don't think it's going to be one of those things. I think he's going to survey his options a little bit. I actually think it's very similar to the Mike Conley situation.
Right.
Like in that he likes Toronto. He's frustrated with the situation. He's been ornery with the media for about a month or two now. The coverage.
Well, also his whole career, but more than usual.
I agree with you. He's like that generally, but he's been even more so lately just because of the fact that the coverage while he had his wrist injury was insufferable. People were writing about them needing to move on, whether they should let him walk. And then the day the playoffs start after game one, there's like idiots bringing trade Kyle Lowry signs to the game and stuff like that. It's just horrible behavior by the fan base and some of the there's no specific members of media who I'm like saying this about, but just like the media was correct in their analysis. Like they were playing well while he was out, but I also think like he's essential in terms of raising the ceiling of this team.
And they also had traded for Ibaka and Tucker, which made a difference, and their schedule was also very light to close the year. Like, there was more than one thing. Like, correlation doesn't always mean causation there.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, too. Yeah, they had two big pickups. Those guys made their debuts while he was out. The schedule got a little bit lighter. And, yeah, they managed to stay afloat. But, I think Lowry's been a little bit frustrated with the situation. I don't think it's a case where he's hell-bent on returning. But I think, ultimately, if they give him enough money, I think Toronto makes a lot of sense for him as a situation and a destination. And you even think about it on a personal level for him. Like, this is where he was able to leave all his previous demons behind, was able to become an all-star. He has, you know, he has comfort here. The franchise respects him. The fan base respects him. DeRozan is one of his closest friends. Like, I think that stuff will end up mattering at the end of the day. But I think, again, it's like the Mike Conley situation where he's frustrated enough to survey the landscape, but ultimately the money and the length of the contract should be more than enough to keep him around.
Right. I think you're right. And the last point there, I think, is important because he's had trouble in the past, and it's something he's talked about fairly openly in recent years, developing trust and really becoming comfortable in a situation. And I think when there isn't a lot of other options for contention, like I think Toronto's probably one of the best teams that he'll be able to sign on. Maybe the Spurs try to lure him away if they're not able to get Chris Paul. But outside of that, I don't think there's a lot of options where you're guaranteed winning. And when you have comfort, it's a place you enjoy playing. As you mentioned, DeRozan, he's very close with. I think that does become very attractive. But it really is tough for Toronto because Kyle Lowry isn't the only free agent that they have. You have Serge Ibaka, you have Patrick Patterson, you have PJ Tucker. And in a lot of ways, I don't think if you let Lowry walk or if he decided to walk, I think it all becomes a lot more difficult to sign Ibaka. Like, I don't think you can just say, okay, we're going to bring back the same team sans Kyle Lowry. I think no matter what they do, they're ultimately going to take a little bit of a step back as a team just because there are so many decisions. You'd have to remove some of the guys that you have there just to bring back your free agents. Like, I think Valanciunas might have to go. Damari Carroll, I could see them trying to shop him. Even Corey Joseph. I mean, if you're bringing back Kyle Lowry and you're a believer in DeLon Wright, having Joseph's salary there when this team's going to start getting expensive in a hurry isn't the most productive thing, or at least isn't the best allocation of your resources.
Yeah, no, totally. And I'm actually like 100% on board with what you're saying. Like, I think to me, the most obvious decision is bringing back Jonas. Lowry and sorry.
Getting rid of Jonas.
Oh, God, yeah. No, but I think the obvious decision is bringing back Lowry and Ibaka if you can, and making that the core that you're paying a lot of money to. And then moving Jonas, Corey, and Carroll if possible, and bringing back potentially one of Ibaka, I mean, Tucker or Patterson. Like, to me, that's like an ideal offseason in terms of personnel moves.
Okay.
It's tough though, man. Like, I think you're definitely locking yourself into, it's not mediocrity. But just a level below contention.
Yeah. You're locking yourself into tier two. Let's call it that.
For sure. Yeah. And unless like there's like some unprecedented development, like Jakob Poeltl turns into Draymond Green or something like that, like which isn't happening anytime soon, but you know,
the White Hakeem.
Like, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's not impossible. I'm kidding. I just think I think a lot of people look at this from a strictly basketball perspective, and I get that. Like, we look at on-court results and that's what matters. I think there's market dynamics that affect this team as well. Like, for a team that's clearly on the third peg in Toronto.
Yeah.
Like, with Maple Leafs and the Blue Jays. I'm sure there's a ton of Blue Jays fans in Winnipeg as well. For the Raptors to maintain some level of respectability and to keep the momentum going in terms of their fan base expanding, it's tough to say bye, man. It's tough to just break this apart and start all over again. I think they've done a lot of valuable work. A lot of the fan base has been reawakened. People have started to feel passionate about this team again. Like, I don't know how, as a team that has to fight and claw to gain some respect in this market, I don't know how you say goodbye to all that.
Yeah, it really is tough. And one of the more depressing aspects of this, at least from an outside perspective, is one of the biggest things Toronto's trying to do is gain that respectability, not only within their own market, but within the league. And we've seen them in recent years be in the running for free agents that wouldn't have even taken a meeting in the past. And they probably dodged a bullet not getting LaMarcus Aldridge. But at the same time, like, if they had a more respectable series against the Cavs, like if this was close games, even if it went like four or five very close games, I think then you become a more attractive market. But the way that they lose, with LeBron really clowning on this team and just no real close margins of victory here. Like, I think it becomes even more difficult. The gap between these teams seems so dramatic, and it's tougher for them to really kind of get the validation that maybe they deserve, at least in comparison to what they're receiving now.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why you see so many people become disillusioned with what's been happening. That's why you see, like, Jurassic Park is a little bit emptier, or, you know, viewership numbers aren't as high as they used to be. Like, people, I know casual fans, like some of my friends who decide not to tune into game 3 or game 4 because it's like, what's the point? We're losing by 20 every game. You know what I mean? Like, I understand that. Like, not everybody is a fanatic like some of us who will watch every game regardless.
Right.
And I totally understand that. And I think, like, something has to give, like, something has to change. Like, at this point, we're looking at 4 years of this roller coaster, 4 years of them not looking particularly good in the playoffs. Like, something has to change. But I just think the easiest thing to change is maybe the message changes in the locker room. You know, like, maybe you bring in somebody with fresh ideas. Like, and it sucks because I like Dwayne Casey, and I think he's been really helpful for the franchise to get them to this point. He's done a really good job of being able to like, his message resonates with the players, and he's gotten DeRozan and Lowry to maximize themselves. I think that's a big deal. But yeah. I just think something has to change, and it's a lot easier to say, you know what, let's just run it back and try it again with a different coach than to say, you know, we're going to change the core of this franchise and see what impact it has. I feel like that's a really big decision to make, whereas coach is also a big decision, but it shouldn't affect the on-court results as much negatively, I would think, if the core remains the same.
Yeah, I agree. And I've said this before, but I think Dwayne Casey is one of the biggest reasons why they overachieved in the past. Mm-hmm. But when you start to look at the deficiencies that he has, that he does forget about guys in the rotation, the adjustments seem slow. And he's also a coach that really does rely heavily on motivation. And when you see so many Raptors players take a step back defensively and not look as engaged this season, I mean, in the past, I've always made jokes about them kind of being the try-hard team, but that effort wasn't always consistently there, and it really took that fresh blood to excite them again. It feels like that motivation's lacking, and a new voice might end up benefiting them in the long run. So it really isn't a tough decision, or it isn't an easy decision, because there's no real guarantee that you're going to get a better coach than Casey. Like, he yeah. has done a good job overall, but just changing up the message, as you said, I think it can go a long way. If you were rebuilding, I'd almost be tempted to keep him around because of the growth you've seen from Lowry, DeRozan, and all the players there. They really have done a good job as an organization developing talent. And if you're going the youth direction, that would be something you'd want to keep. But if you are running it back, I'm with you. Maybe a new voice will benefit the team. Maybe you bring in Stackhouse, who at the very least will end up brawling with the player if they come off with no energy. So if you're Masai and yep. you have full reins of this team, what are you going to be doing this summer? What would be an ideal summer in terms of realistic targets, player retention, and direction for the team?
Yeah, I have yet to crunch the cap numbers completely. But again, like I said, you bring back Serge and Kyle. You keep DeRozan. I think you replace the head coach. I think you know, and it hurts to say this, man. Like, Dwayne Casey's been one of us for a long time now, for like 7 years. We've seen a lot of growth within the team during his watch. So it's not an easy decision, like you said. But I think it's coming to that time. You replace the head coach. You trade JV. Look, I think.
All right, what are you getting for JV? This honestly, is something I'm very curious about.
Honestly, at this point, I think it's pretty much a salary dump, and I think like even that is going to be hard to find. Like, why would the Philadelphia 76ers want JV, or why would the Brooklyn Nets want JV? Like, it's hard to find teams that are even willing to accept him on a salary dump. Maybe it's one of those cases where you have to pair him. You have to pair him with a sweetener like Corey Joseph to get something back. You know, like, maybe it's one of those things. I don't really know, but I think, look, the Raptors have enough replacements ready for JV. I think Jakob Poeltl is ready. Like, I straight up think he's ready now.
I agree. I'm very high on Poeltl. Even just from a basketball IQ standpoint, he seems further along than Jonas is. Like,
he does. He's very smart. He generally makes the right decision on short rolls and in the pick and roll. He's quite feisty on the glass. He's good defensively. That's what I really like about him. He's mobile, and I think he gives them a different look while also being, you know, I think he has a high-ish ceiling on offense to be like an efficient producer. So I think moving on from JV, you try to do that. You try to move on from Carroll. I feel like teams, I still think Carroll has value.
Like, I think so too. I think some team would take a chance on him.
Right. Like, and I'm just throwing this out there. Like, take the Pelicans. You're telling me the Pelicans wouldn't want a guy like Damari Carroll, like, in place of, like, I don't know, Dante Cunningham or whoever they're running out there right now? Like, Etuan Moore or whatever? I don't know who they're even playing. But the point is, I think some teams will talk themselves into a theoretical 3-and-D guy.
Because it's hard to find. Like, everyone's like, oh, just trade so-and-so for a 3-and-D player. There aren't legitimate 3-and-D players available. They're like, there's not many in the league, forget available. Yeah. So I think teams would take a chance. I think you're right there.
Yeah, and I think, and you know, there's an argument to be had about whether he is a 3-and-D player anymore, but I think at least in terms of pass production, he has been there in the past. So some teams would talk themselves into it if they could get him for on the cheap, right?
And he only has 1 year left on his deal, right? Like next year,
I think he has two. Next year and then 1 more year after.
He signed a 5-year deal.
4-year.
Well, this is his third year with the Raptors, right?
I think it's his second. It's his second year.
Oh God, it feels like so long.
It does. It's been a long and bumpy ride, man. It's not been great. And then I think you also try to move on from Corey Joseph. Like, that moves a lot of salary, because I think DeLon Wright and Fred VanVleet are both ready. So
wait. Yeah. DeLon, I can get behind, but VanVleet, you really think that's like a thing?
I think he's a capable third point guard. I don't think he's a backup yet, but I think if you had to use him, say DeLon got hurt for like 15 games and you had to ride with Fred VanVleet, I think you'd be all right.
Man.
I think he's pretty decent. He's so tiny, man. He's really tiny. But I think like he tries hard enough on defense and he's smart enough in terms of navigating pick and rolls and hitting open jumpers that I think he could survive. Like I'm not saying he's a world beater by any means, but I think you can stay afloat with Fred VanVleet as a backup.
Yeah, I always felt like he'd give you a good 2-3 minutes, and if he played more than that, all of a sudden the other team like would figure out what he's doing. But
that's probably true. But I think in the regular season, teams don't really care.
No, they don't. Like, they don't scout. There's not a whole lot of.
Yeah, your team is a good case in point for that, man.
That is, painfully true.
Yeah, I think you trade those three guys. I'm not sure exactly what you get. I'm hoping that they can draft somebody who can be an immediate contributor off the bench, like maybe like a Semi Ojeleye, one of those guys. I would love it if they would take a chance on somebody like Harry Giles from Duke, but if they're looking for immediate contributors, there are other guys out there, like maybe Jaron Blossom Game, guys like that.
Now, is Bruno stepping up next year?
I think that he might need 1 more year, but I think Bruno is close. I think he's close.
Man.
I think he can be like a stretch four. I think he can do it.
It's funny because he doesn't have bad mechanics on his jumper. It's just like...
The numbers are bad.
Are they?
I think he's shooting like 31% from three this year in the D League. But here's the thing. I think Blake Murphy from Raptors Republic has done a lot of good work reporting on the D League, and Bruno is ready defensively. Like, he's there. He's already good enough. He can already make a difference defensively. And with his jump shot, I think like he's working his way into understanding his limitations offensively. But once he starts taking better shots, his percentages should go up. I think he's going to be a contributor down the line. I still believe.
Gotta believe in the Bruno.
Hey man, you can't ignore that 8-foot wingspan or whatever the hell it is.
His measurements truly are ridiculous.
Listen, I've had the chance to watch him like basically courtside at the D League because D League media is like right next to the court.
Okay.
It is. First of all, Eddie Tavares is just gigantic. He's probably the biggest person I've ever seen in my life.
Sing Eddie's praises, because we don't have a lot of young guys to get really excited about. Like, it's basically Kyrie. Well, Tristan's young too, but I mean, Kyrie's basically the same age as DeLon Wright, so he's still on the upswing. But Eddie Tavares and Chetty Osman.
Are all about Chetty Osman, man.
I'm very about Chetty. I'm finally deciding to say his name properly. I was always saying Chetty, but I've heard enough people now tell me that it's Chetty that I'm going to have to do it properly.
Well, he's coming next year, so you're going to have to learn. You're going to have to learn.
It's true.
Eddie Tavares. Eddie Tavares, man, I think he's like 7'3". He's absolutely massive. He's way more mobile than you'd think. Like, one of the biggest problems he had was just the fact that he used to be just a large lump of a human being, and he wouldn't be able to. He was kind of like JV in the sense like he was lumbering and wasn't very agile and wouldn't move well laterally. But I think he's developed enough in the sense that he understands spacing a lot. Like, think Marc Gasol. Marc Gasol isn't particularly quick, but he understands like the limits of his wingspan and how he can affect shots well enough. that he gets to the right spot in time. And he's that type of a disruptor of shots. Like, I think you saw in that last game against the Raptors of the regular season where he came in and I think he had like 7 blocks. Was it 7?
Yeah, it was like 6 or 7 blocks. It was crazy. Yeah.
It was 6 blocks in like 20 minutes or something like that. And that's the type of shot blocker he is, man. He can get his hands on absolutely anything. He knows his limits offensively. I think he's still coming around. He still needs some work on the offensive end of the court. He can't really do much besides finish on offensive rebounds and lobs and stuff like that. But again, for a guy that you guys are taking a complete flyer on and you can invest some time into, I think he's shown enough that it's worth hanging on to. Like, I think he has a chance to be like a bench contributor. I definitely think he can be like a Baby Nogueira type.
That would be fun, because as I said, there's not a lot of ways that the Cavs can really improve their roster, just with the salary cap restraints. But hitting a couple home runs on these guys would make a huge, huge difference. Now, who had the better Raptors career, Jonas or Bargnani? Assuming Jonas comes to a close this year.
Oh my God!
I'm sorry to hurt you with that one, but I need to know. Because that was a sick thought that popped in my head the other day. Come on, man.
I think, again, recency bias is affecting our frustrations with Jonas, but let's not forget how that Bargnani era ended.
Bargnani averaged 20 points per game for 1 year with you guys, didn't he?
Doesn't matter. I hated every bit of that year. I hated every second of that year. Oh, man. The Bargnani era is, again, but the fact that we're even having this conversation is not a great look for Jonas.
It really isn't. I remember when Bargnani would miss a shot and immediately look over to expect Rasho Nesterich to come onto the court.
Oh, man, Bargnani. Bargnani was... The fact that he was allowed to lead a team and average 20 points a game is, like, that tells you all you need to know about the mid-2000s Raptors.
Man, those were dark days.
Those were horrible days.
I don't think, no matter what happens this summer, I don't think the Raptors would go into that level of despair, because you guys do have good depth and there's potential there. I don't think there's any way that they would move on from DeRozan. There's a lot of, I've seen a few people kind of bring that up. But I think what DeRozan represents, the loyalty he's shown to the franchise, the first All-Star really that you guys have retained since the second year, or his second contract, I think that means a lot for the franchise, and how you treat players impacts free agency. And I think that's something people forget. They like to think of it strictly from a basketball and X's and O's standpoint. But DeRozan, I think he's a respected player around the league. You see guys appreciate what he's able to do, and he is still on his way up, and he has been improving. So I don't think there's any way that you can move on from him.
No, I don't think so either. And, you know, again, you make a really good point about, I think loyalty in sports is generally overrated. It's like a talking point for fans.
It's mostly whack. Like,
it's whack as hell, man. But I think, like, in some cases it actually shines through. And I think DeRozan is one of those cases where, let's be honest, like, he didn't take much of a discount to come back to the Raptors. But
no, you know, no, he really didn't.
No, he took a little bit of a discount, but I still think that should be commended. And in general, I think he's always carried himself with, like, respect towards the fans, respect towards the organization. And I think him and Masai are on the same page. I think stuff like that really matters, man. I think having a guy like DeRozan, who, like you said, is respected around the league, to carry the message forward about the Raptors, and even from a marketability standpoint, like, having a guy who can be the face of the franchise, like, if Larry was to walk, like, this is DeRozan's franchise completely at that point. Like, having somebody to build your team around and somebody to put up as the face of the franchise, I think that stuff is important, especially for a team like the Raptors, who, like, again, like I'm saying, they need all the help they can get in terms of finding their footing in this market. You can't undersell that. You can't undersell the importance of DeMar DeRozan. And yeah, I get it. I get he has limitations. I get that he can't really play off ball. I understand all of that. But it's not like he's a complete black hole at this point. Like, he's a
No, he has grown as a passer this year. I think the only or the most valid frustration with DeRozan would be his defense. Like,
yeah, and that's fair. I think his defensive limitations are definitely fair. He's really, really frustrating to watch at times, but I'm still willing to live with it just because of the load that he carries, and I don't think his defensive instincts are great either. Like, you watch, I feel like people made the James Harden conversation a lot about how bad James Harden is on defense. I just think James Harden didn't care for a long time.
He can play defense. Like, he's not Russell Westbrook bad.
Yeah, no, he can D up, man. I've seen quite a few instances of him against the Raptors where he'll shock you with the stuff that he can do.
When he was in OKC, he was a defensive guy. Like, that was the thing, right? He was their stopper.
Yeah, he was a two-way guy, and I think, again, James Harden just doesn't care at times, but I think he can D up. I think DeRozan is different in that I think his instincts are bad, and that sucks, but it sucks. And, like, DeRozan is so frustrating because he's pretty much maximized everything he can do with the skill set he has, but, like, he needs a crutch in terms of he needs a defensive guy next to him who can cover the best offensive option for the other team. And you need floor spacers and a guy who can play off ball at point. Otherwise, it's very hard. Everything is cramped. Spacing is horrible. Like, that's why him and Corey Joseph never really mesh. And that's the other thing about Lowry, man. And I think that's the thing about Kyrie and Love as well that people don't give them credit for. Being an all-star and being so good at playing off ball, that stuff is underrated, man. Not many guys can do that. Not many guys can do that, and those three guys can definitely do it, and I think that's a big deal.
This series really has kind of highlighted the struggles that DeRozan does have defensively, though, because against the Bucks, you can get away with it to some extent. Like, Tony Snell burns you, but when Damari Carroll can't defend LeBron, which was one of the things he was brought in to do, when Norman Powell can't defend LeBron, but they're still trying on him. Having Kyle Korver and J.R. Smith run around wide open and not really have to work to get these wide open 3-point shots really, really has burnt them, because they're shooting a crazy percentage on wide open 3-point shots. And part of that is that they're not having to run through screens. They're not really working off ball. They're just, the versatility has improved for the Raptors, but I still feel like there's so many instances where they need someone to hide on. Like, when you come up against this level of competition, it's, okay, where can we hide Jonas? Where can we hide DeRozan? And that's just not something that you can really get away with at this point of the playoffs.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. Like, and I think some of those guys are, it's they get hurt on both ends, you know? Like, I think, one, they get hurt on the defensive end because they're hiding guys like Jonas. I remember that there was that one play in game two where Kyrie Irving was trying to take PJ Tucker off the bounce, and PJ Tucker stayed with him the whole time. The shot clock went down to like three, and for some reason, Jonas decided to start helping on Kyrie and just left Fry wide open in the corner, and Fry hit the shot, obviously. And PJ Tucker was like visibly upset, like, dude, what are you doing? Like, I was right there. Like, we almost got that play done. I think that's like a microcosm of people's frustrations with Jonas Valanciunas, and DeMar's the same way defensively. So you have that on one end, and then on the offensive end, you have the ability for teams like the Cavs and the Bucks to absolutely ignore Patrick Patterson or absolutely ignore Damari Carroll and PJ Tucker, and you can just be like, you know what, if you guys are going to hit like six threes against us, that's fine, we're willing to live with that,
right?
And they just never get burned for it. So on the defensive end, there are certain guys that are hurting you. On the offensive end, it's the complete opposite. They have very few players that are productive and efficient on both ends of the court that can make a difference. Like, Ibaka's one of them. Lowry's one of them. Norman Powell can be one of them. But besides that, it's slim pickings, man.
Before we wrap this up, I'm going to rapid fire a few teams. And I want you to tell me where you see them next year, or at least where you see them in relation to the Raptors. Okay. Let's go with the Bucks.
Better. I think they'll be better.
You think they'll be better than the Raptors?
Wait, let me think. Yeah, I want to say they'll be better.
Because the Bucks long-term scare me as a Cavs fan. Like, I feel like that's going to be the team that eventually ends up beating LeBron. I know the Boston Celtics, who we'll touch on next, feel like they're going to be the ones. But the Bucks, man, they have so many things that make life a living hell for teams. And I just think once they get a little more experience, once these players get a little bit better, and obviously the health of Jabari Parker is a big factor, but man, that's going to be a good team. Where do you think the Celtics will be?
Okay, I think I'm going back on the Bucks. I don't think they have enough depth yet. I think they're still relying on like Tony Snell. Well, Tony Snell's fine, but I don't know.
You want him off the bench. You want him off the bench, ideally.
Yeah, and like is Thon Maker really like going to be a difference maker in year two? Like, I don't know yet. Like, I'll say the Raptors will be better for another year.
Okay.
Celtics. Goddamn Celtics.
Because I'm not saying the Celtics are better than the Raptors this year. I know they might. I don't even know if they're going to get by Washington, but.
I think the Celtics will be better. There's enough there for them to be better.
What about Washington?
Damn. I think Washington's going to be worse.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I think this was kind of a ceiling year for the Wizards.
Those guys still hate each other, man.
That's kind of a factor.
Yeah, like this stuff is just like hide, like sweeping the issues they have under the rug. The fact that Beal and Wall don't like each other, I feel like that's kind of important.
Man, and I'm going to just go out on a limb and assume that you think the Cavs are going to be better.
Listen, no one is stopping the Cavs, man. Honestly, this sounds like I'm jinxing you guys. I'm really not trying to, but I was talking with a friend about this. Like, I think the Warriors are definitely favorites, but I'm starting to see a path for the Cavs to win now. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm starting to see it a little bit, and I think that's all you can ask for, man.
Like, oh, for sure. Like, I think they have a better chance than they did last year. And I've said this a million times. I think last year they really needed all those breaks. But there still feels like there's a little bit of a 2011 Miami thing going on with the Warriors. Like, it does take time for these stars to learn how to play together. Like, it took time for the Cavs. It's not easy when you have these roles changing. And obviously, getting Kevin Durant was the right move. But at the same time, like, they don't have as many shooters. Like, you can start to do more things against the Warrior stars because they don't have the same role players. They don't have 3-point shooters from 1 through 12 anymore. Like, they can start to, the Cavs can do the same overloading and directing shots to different guys that they do against other teams.
For sure. And I think, like, even you look at offensively right now, LeBron has more weapons than he's had at any point in his Cavs career yet.
It's crazy. At this point.
Like, you know, like any given night, there's like Fry, or maybe Fry won't have as much of an impact in that Warrior series, but you have Fry, you have Korver, J.R. Smith, Kyrie and Love. Like, that's an insane number of guys who can hit shots.
Even Richard Jefferson can shoot.
Like, Richard Jefferson isn't even playing right now, and he's like just waiting on the bench, ready to be unleashed. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And then Tristan Thompson is goddamn amazing, man.
He really would be the perfect center for this Raptors team.
I feel like he's so underrated. Like, he does so much for the Cavs. Like, he covers up so much of their flaws. Like, having a guy like that, clean up in terms of, like, the Raptors had almost no offensive rebounds. He's so seamless in terms of switching on defense. He can do a decent job defending the paint. Like, he's a perfect player to play for this Cavs team because he helps you cover a lot of the flaws that some of the defenders have. And again, LeBron right now, does LeBron look better right now than he did last year at this point?
Man, he's looked better this year than he has the past 3 or 4 years. Like, it's crazy.
He's looked amazing. He's looked like he went back to being like peak LeBron. Like, it's really weird.
He almost looks better than he did his last year in Miami.
He looks amazing. He looks completely rejuvenated, and his shot is back. Like, his shot looks lethal as hell. Like, he's draining pull-ups without a problem.
I don't think he's ever looked this like confident and comfortable too. Like, I feel like he really is kind of playing with no fucks to give.
And I think people have finally, like, people have definitely just accepted that, yeah, LeBron is the best player in the world, and he is the difference maker. Like, I think at this point last year, people were still on that Steph Curry side of things, and that's understandable. Steph Curry had an amazing year, but I think given what happened in the finals, people are finally accepting the fact that, yeah, LeBron is the ultimate trump card they have. Like, he is.
People have bought into the Switch.
Dude, that Switch is very real, man. Like,
the Cavs legitimately might be an 8 seed next year with their ability to turn it on and off.
Why not? Like, if they, why would they not need? Why don't they just get the 8 seed and just beat the Celtics? Like, right?
Yeah,
away?
Because Boston, you know, would just be so happy to get that 1 seed again.
Yeah, they'll be trying their asses off, like, like just like making like 15 point comebacks in like 2 minutes, like in like game 64 of the regular season. Like, what are you doing? Just let the shit go. Forget the 1 seed. Cavs tank the whole season. LeBron rest like 25 games and still beat the Celtics in 4. You know what? I'm rooting for that. I'm rooting for you guys to do that.
My only fear with the Celtics is injury. Other than that, it should be 4 or 5 games tops.
Look, Kelly Olynyk, he's coming after LeBron's ACL, man. He's taking that ACL home with him.
Like, I really don't even want you joking about that. Yeah, that wound is still really fresh.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but you know, I'm just letting you know, man. Keep your eyes peeled.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, man. Really do appreciate you coming on, and basically saying good things about Tristan Thompson will get you future appearances. So
noted for.
I'm sorry that your season had to end this way. Well, I'm not that sorry, but maybe the fashion that it ended is a little depressing. Just because I really did feel like coming in that this was basically going to be the conference finals. Because for anyone that knows me, I'm not very sold on Washington and Boston, and I really felt like the Toronto had the weapons to make the Cavs work on both ends, and that just that never really came to fruition this year.
Switch is real, man. The Switch is real. I'm never trusting you guys ever again. I'm never going to trust the Cavs being bad or looking bad at any point. Until they prove me otherwise, I'm going to assume they're going to win.
Man, poor 538. They just take so many L's by really taking stock in what the Cavs do in the regular season.
Yeah, I feel like the Cavs break so many statistical models just because they give so few fucks.
It's really incredible.
Yeah, well, now these statistical models got to add a new variable, fucks given during regular season.
I don't know how you account for that, but it's the next frontier in statistics. So thanks again for coming on. To all our listeners, we appreciate you guys listening, the feedback. Remember that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, basically anywhere that you find podcasts. And if you feel so inclined, leave us a review. But we appreciate all the support. And until next time, go Cavs.